Me.
Welcome, everybody. So we will finish today a ma'amar, one of the ma'amar we're working on about, for which the Zohar is named. Zo is called, so, as we get into more of this, the Zohar was published in manuscripts, and as Professor Alan Brill noted, I don't know if people know Professor Alan Brill, professor of comparative religion at Seton Hall University. He's done a particular amount of work with Hinduism and Judaism. See his semi-autobiographical work, Rabbi on the Ganges. He is also a rabbi, which is I've read parts of it and is pretty fascinating. He noted in a response to, a lot of people have been saying things about authenticity of the Zohar around Lag BaOmer. Every year around Lag BaOmer, various people, social media and other places start speaking about who ex everyone has an opinion about who and wrote the Zohar and when. And he noted that from an academic perspective, the conversation is artificial because there's one section of the Zohar, which we apparently know from another work found in the Cairo Geniza, called Nistarot Shel Rashbi, the hidden adventures, really, of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, which apparently appear in some of the sections on Shemot. And we know that those date from the 7th and 8th centuries. And we have other sections of the Zohar, like the prayer Brich Shemei Damari Alma, or sections of the Tikkuni Zohar, which we seem to know date from early manuscripts in the 14th and even early 15th century. And so the Zohar really is a kind of midrashic collection, the core of which emerges from, Castile in the latter half of the 13th century. But it's not as if there's, like someone wrote the Zohar at a particular time. This is what his point was, that it's a much more organic process than that, that got the book we have in front of us. But the things were often referred to, not in volumes when they came out, but the name of the ma'amar, the name of the teaching. And so we're doing ma'amar kizohar harakia, like the radiance of the firmament is how this would have often been referred to. If people, Kabbalists would have quoted the ma'amar, they would have been working from different editions. They wouldn't say mat edition, page, whatever. They would have said, the ma'amar zohar harakia. And then whenever, wherever it is, because some versions have it here, some have it there, you'd know what teaching you're talking about. So we're about to finish that. And of course, that is the Ma'amar for which the whole book eventually took its name. It's on the cover of the mat, I think, right? Is it there? That verse? Amaskilin Yaziru Kazohara Harakia. Is that on the cover? I have my Kindle with me today, but no, it's not there. Maybe it's not on the cover.
No.
I take it back. In any event, let us finish this title. There's something else on the cover. We ended last time by saying this teaching that the enlightened will shine like the Zohar radiance of the sky. After this, we're going to do the Ma'amar of Tohu and Vohu, which is a famous Ma'amar, Tohu and Vohu of the Zohar. Well, they're all famous, except for the ones that aren't, but these two are particularly known. So we ended by saying the enlightened will shine like the Zohar radiance of the sky. These are pillars and sockets of that pavilion. Hamaskilim, the enlightened supernal pillars and sockets, contemplating in wisdom everything needed by that pavilion and its supports. Now, keep in mind here that the pavilion is a little bit upside down. We're trying to imagine the pavilion. This is a way, we have this picture of the Sefirot in the form of a chart, in the form of a tree, I guess is the way to think of it. But the Zohar wasn't yet working with as fixed a conception. of what the spheriotic chart was. It was more of, as Malila likes to call it, a legend, not a map. I think that's a useful way of talking about the Sfirot. And so when they're describing a pavilion, an apeiron, in the, I went and looked in the Sulam edition that Joe had referenced last week. It's called the apeiron, which is taken from Shir HaShirim, the apeiron of King Solomon, which is a hapax legomenon, did we say? I think it appears only there. And some debates about the origin of the word. The Shekhinah, the divine presence, is the thing you're hoping the pavilion will contain, the top of the pavilion. And Chesed, Gevurah, Tiferet, Netzach, Hod, Yesod, respectively, are the sockets and the pillars, the Adanim and the so, you know, the upper triad are the supernal pillars here, I believe. And the sockets are, this is my interpretation. I don't know if Matt says anything about this or not. You're working with the Kindle edition, the footnote. No, it doesn't say that. But I will say supernal pillars must refer to Chesed, Gevurah, Tiferet, and sockets must refer to Netzach, Hod, Yesod, I think. And so those cause the Shekhinah to be supported, to exist. What's interesting here, that this mystery accords with that, what is said, happy is maskil, right? One who considers the poor, the dal, and the dal, the poor, is the Shekhinah, because the Shekhinah can only receive flow from above, but does not generate on her own. And what is really radical about this teaching, you may notice, is it places the maskilim, the enlightened, in the position of being higher up in the divine chart than God as constructed God's self. Right? In other words, the Shekhinah is Adonai, God who we pray to, the God in our lives, etc. And here the mystics are, you know, channels or conduits for divine flow placed above Shekhinah.
Where do we know that they're ab above, Rabbi?
Well, it says here, the enlightened will shine like the Zohar, radiance of the sky. These maskilim are pillars and sockets of that pavilion. So assuming my interpretation, which is again my interpretation, you know, eternal, which he then says, hamaskilim, the enlightened, supernal pillars. So if we imagine we, the mystics, are supernal pillars, we become the Chesed, Gevurah, Tiferet, Netzach, Hod, Yesod. We, by living lives of cosmic divine balance, empower or disempower Shekhinah. So that's a way of saying we create, you know, it's almost like the rabbinic sermon of, like, you know, where was God in the Holocaust, you know, or these kinds of questions. And people say, well, with the helpers and the aid workers and the righteous Gentiles and whatever. It's kind of similar in a certain way. It's like, you know, people create the divine reality through their, you know, here it's not actions as much as consciousness or state of mind, I think, for the Zohar first. But, and it must be done in accordance with this legend, you know, of this Sfirot. Which is to say, this is also an interesting piece. They imagine that when a mystic is doing their mystical work, you have to do it with balance, right? This becomes important. In other words, you have to do it for the sake of the Shekhinah. So it's not just for the sake of the Shekhinah in this teaching. It's a little deeper, you see. One has to do it understanding the needs, the divine needs at the moment. So there's a kind of guru-like or shamanic aspect to this. One has to perceive what thing is out of balance at that moment and correct for it as a mystic, all with a vision in mind of a particular outcome of a shechina that's fully manifest with divine flow. So it's almost like, we've all been part of organizations that are vision or mission driven and organizations that are like hapless and floundering, I think, right? Evan, we all been part of both of those. So I kind of imagine like, you could either be a mystic part of an organization without like clear, doesn't know quite what it's doing and a lot of infighting and there's no game plan that everyone's bought into. Or it could be part of a really healthy organization that knows its goals and has different personalities on board to balance out each other's strengths and weaknesses, and everyone's working as a team. So they imagine a kind of mystical team with a game plan, not just random actions of an isolated mystic, right? Which even is a chiddush for mysticism, that your mysticism isn't something you do alone, but it's something you do in balance with others, in balance with time, in balance with needs. It's very engaged. In fact, one has to, yeah.
I was going to say, so isn't this, because it's interesting. I mean, that's the whole idea of the like modern, but the 18th century Hasidic movement, right? Is like it's supposed to be, to some extent, it's supposed to be a movement kind of about the people. You're not supposed to go up to a mountain and be isolated, though I guess that's what the Besh did for a certain amount of time, but it's supposed to be about being a mystic, like within a community, within people, or am I off on that? I mean, I think about like the modern, like the whole Chabad thing is like you're supposed to go to college campuses and go everywhere and kind
Right.
of
So,
end up.
there is the famous story of the Maggid of Mezrich who came to the Baal Shem Tov, whose knees were weakened from, ascetic practices and fasting, and who was in a frail state as a result of his piety. And the Besht healed him by showing him that, there was another way of avodah shebagashmias, right, of worship in the present tense. And he was very impressed with this new path. So yes, the Hasidim certainly took the idea of active engagement. I will say that this idea is the core motivation, I think, of the Hasidic movement, which I mentioned last time, to do things for the sake of the Shechina. In Sabbat HaRivash, an early accounting of statements, the Besh was accustomed to say, one of the very first things listed in that book of kind of sayings of the Besh. It's a little bit legendary, but I think we have it from every one of the students of the Besh, so I think we know that he said this quite a lot. A few things, right? Late atar panoi mineh, no place is devoid of God's presence. And also everything you should do for the sake of the Shechina, which is part of why the Lashem Yichuds became so popularized. I'm doing it for the sake of what? Lashem Yichud kutshebrichu shechinteh, for the sake of the unification of Tiferet with the Shechina. That's literally what everyone said before, b'shem kol Yisrael, in the name of everyone. Right, so the Besh literally encouraged people to say before every mitzvah, I'm doing it for the sake of the Shechina, or better yet, for the unification of the Sfirot in the Shechina. And then they started printing it in the Sidurim. So I don't know if they're in the Sidurim of, are they in like the new conservative Sidur? Does anyone know? The Shem Yichuds.
Not really, no.
They took it out. Yeah, they took it out of the new RCA, Rabbinical Council of America Sidur as well. They removed them. So I think it's, most people don't know what that means. Most people don't say that. But the Zohar says that here. So will shine. Right? Hamaskilim. So far we're only on Hamaskilim. So that all of that was a commentary a little bit on Maskilim. Who is a Maskil? What is a Maskil? Why is a Maskil? Yazhiru will shine. For unless they shine and radiate, they cannot contemplate that pavilion. Well, like, so now we're into the how. First we were at the what, and now, or the why, and now we're at the how. How does a maskil shine in a way that brings light to the Shechina? For unless they shine and radiate, they cannot contemplate that pavilion looking out for all its needs. See, so this is, I think the Zohar often likes to set us up, right? So they already set us up with the maskilim being the pillars and sockets, referring, I believe, clearly to the upper and lower triad of Sefirot. And so once you do that, you know you're in a relationship. And in particular, pillars and sockets are connectors. Like that's the metaphor. Pillars and sockets they're not the building. They're the thing that connect and hold up the building, right? So they're in a supporting and connective role. But here they're just going to amplify that then. Well, shine, unless these maskilim actually affect, that is, go beyond their own consciousness, they cannot contemplate that pavilion. It would be easy to go over this with no footnote, as is what the case here. This is a crucial teaching in the Zohar, I want to say, because this is reflective of that which we learned in the Hakdama, the first of the 14 Hakdama mitzvot about Yirah, that the Zohar understands that any, as it'll say later, any mystic who says, Ani Amoch, I will rule over others. But it's about, there's a sense of ego in that, which is easy to happen. We all know how easy it is for religiosity to become about being better than other people, for anyone, for all of us. For we certainly, it's easy to see in other people who think they're better than you. Yeah, I think we can all imagine, if we wanted to, we might not want to, people who, because of their own religiosity, know that they're better than we are. It's not, there's a long list of people. yes, of many religions, mind you. Judaism has no monopoly on this. And it's been the source of so much religious violence, yeah? And religious terror. I mean, it's where religion goes wrong. So this is what the Zohar is saying here. Unless you shine and radiate. If it's about you, then it's going to be bad, and it won't be for God. But if you shine and radiate, that is, you have an outward sense about the religiosity. It's not for your own purpose, but for a purpose of connection. Then, and only then, can you actually contemplate the Shekhinah and all of its needs. You cannot connect to God if you're worried about yourself. Or as the Talmud will say, Ein ani v'hu dar b'makom echad, right? God says about an arrogant person, says the Talmud, I can't be in the same room as someone who's an arrogant person, says God, in the Talmudic way of saying it. I think this is the mystical version of that teaching, right? Unless the maskilim yazhiru, unless they're doing it for a relatively altruistic purpose, then it won't be for me. It'll be look like that, but it will really be demonic in the most strong way of saying it. It doesn't say that here, but I said it. So like the Zohar, okay, so now we have Hamaskilim Yaziru, Kizohar Harakia. So now we're gonna focus on this Zohar. Maybe this is the conclusion of the Zohar teaching.
Just the end of that sentence caught my eye. Looking out for all its needs. What are the needs of the Shekhinah that Nim provide? I know she is poor and in exile and receives the flow from it. But what does she need?
What does she need? According to Rav Yosef Karo and the revelation of Shavuot, she needs not to be put in the dumpster in that one, to have Israel and Judaism restored to a place of glory internally and externally. In other words, to be itself a source of true teaching for the world, and also for the world not to demean the Jewish people and the Jewish religion. That's for sure one of the needs, is the preeminence of the Torah and Israel and the Jewish people. You know, that teaching could go off the rails too, as it has in some segments of the religious Zionist community in Israel. You could go quickly from that to a version of Otzma Yehudit, Jewish supremacy, which is racist and vile, pretty quickly. But that's not here. They imagine it in the most kind of messianic, universal, idealistic way. What else does the Shekhinah need, though? I'll open it up. You know, what does the Shekhinah need? She needs flow from above, right? In a balanced way.
Well, maybe we rescue her from her exile.
She needs a rescue. We are in 13th century Spain. She's a damsel in distress.
Yeah.
Right? I think that metaphor is very real to them.
Yeah.
The Shekhinah is a captive in a tower somewhere, you know?
Isn't there the notion of like adorning the Shekhinah too, which I guess is maybe offering a metaphor when you're looking for something more concrete, but that is that not part of that teaching?
The Shekhinah needs a husband. And in order to get a husband, my wife doesn't like this metaphor of the Zohar. She thinks it's like very, like, couldn't they have come up with something more dignified? She needs to look beautiful. She needs jewelry and makeup and...
Well, that's the Shavuot teaching.
That's the Shavuot tikkun, right? But like on Shavuot, what does she need? She needs us to make her beautiful. And how do we make her beautiful? By reciting sections of Torah, Chidushei Torah.
Beauty in the eyes of the Jewish people and the world. That's, I think, a really important insight.
Yeah. Yeah. Great question. What does the Shekhinah need? All its needs, because the idea of God with needs is, of course, to a philosopher, a disaster. This is a disaster if you're Maimonides.
Right.
This whole, you know, you need to do things for, just replace it with the divine presence and everything that she needs. Ah, it's just a, you know, idolatrous mess. But of course, remember that the Shekhinah is a projection we help create. And people need a God they can relate to, and that God needs to have needs. You know, Chabad said, Ein melech b'lo am. The Shekhinah needs a nation of subjects. That's what the Baal HaTanya said. That's the Chabad statement. Ein melech b'lo am. There's no king. Here the Shekhinah has become a king without a nation. Maybe that's a resonant metaphor given the British monarchy. But it is not, you know, joking aside, I think I watched a brief replay of the crowning of a king. Ceremony was a little dry, but you do get a feel that there is quite a pomp and circumstance to the, you get why the monarchy, especially when the monarchs actually had real power, was a pretty significant metaphor for people. Like, I don't think I fully appreciated the metaphor. Watching a coronation, even that coronation helped a little bit to me. Kizohar Arakia. Like, if anyone else thinks of other needs of the Shekhinah, please. Okay. Like the Zohar, radiance of the sky. She needs not to be forgotten, I'll say. She needs attention. Don't we all need attention? She needs 100 blessings every day. Right? That, I will say, tefillah becomes important for what the Shekhinah needs as a devotional service. And the famous letter of Amram Gon, is it? When the Jews of Sfarad asked what should be the order of tefillot, am I quoting the right? And he responded with the first printed siddur, in effect, in the form of a letter. Here are the prayers that you should say every day. And then he wrote a siddur. And in that letter, he introduces it by saying that the siddur is meant to fulfill the rabbinic dictum that a person should say 100 blessings every day so that they don't forget God. So I think the most important part of the first siddur is the very brief introductory paragraph, which frames it as a way not to forget God. That's an interesting purpose statement for the siddur, and framing it in light of the rabbinic statement, which I just thought was a homily, that a person should recite 100 blessings every day. Like the Zohar, radiance of the sky, standing, turning the page to portfolio 16 or folio 16a, above the enlightened, of whom it is written, an image above the heads of the living being, a sky like awesome ice. Let me just read that in the Hebrew. Of course, I'm reading the Hebrew from the Aramaic Zohar I have in front of me, not a Tanakh. Of course I am. So if there's anything that's different in the actual, let me know. Udmut al rashea chaya rakia ke'en hakerach hanora. Udmut, the image, al rashea chaya, above the plural, heads of the chaya, living being, but here chaya has the specific notion, not just of a living being, but what of one of the angels of the class of chayot, I think. Rakia, above the image of the heads of the living being, and this was a firmament or a sky, ke'en, like the awesome, wondrous, terrible ice. So here we have an image from Ezekiel, soon to be in the Haftorah, Shavuos morning. I had a rabbi in rabbinical school. Of course, the Haftorah predated the, it's because of the theophany, the divine revelation. But I had a rabbi in rabbinical school who liked to joke that they instituted this Haftorah for Shavuos morning because no one's awake. I get what he's saying. So let's just not run away from these images, which we often do, but let's actually like imagine the image. We have this depiction of something that is the angelic stand-in for God. And above the plural heads of this thing that is the stand-in for God is an ice-like sky feature. So we have the mat footnote. I'll read it. The sky is Tiferet, who stands above the enlightened, specifically Netzach and Hod, also called the heads. The living being, Chaya, is Shekhinah, who controls and sustains the holy Chayot. Living creatures or animals, they're angel-like living creatures or animals who support the Merkava, the chariot, the divine throne. So here we have a teaching that surely harkens back to the Merkava school. And again, there's one professor, what's her name, who's done a lot of writing about the links that in time and place of the Kabbalah to the prior Merkava schools of Jewish mysticism of the Gaonic and earlier periods. There are some clear linkages, and I suspect she thinks a lot of these passages are, you know, from that. And maybe the Chasidei Ashkenaz are a bridge for her, you know, Yehuda Chasid and some of the mystical non-Kabbalists of 11th and 12th century Ashkenaz. But so just to understand, we're now delving in. We're like going in. We had the supernal pillars and now the sockets. Right. And so the mystics are shining like what? Like Tiferet, who controls this whole wheel of things. Right. And Tiferet here is actually pictured. So here the Zohar is getting not anthropomorphic because I'm pictured like ice in the form of the sky. It's an actual image.
Morphic.
It's a morphic image. We know what ice looks like, and we imagine that they have some kind of trippy thing that has depth and texture to it, but is also translucent and crystalline, right? It's beautiful. Presumably, it's quite beautiful in this image. And that thing is a source of disparate divine energy and connections, right? The water is firm, right? So there things are connected in ways that they were in motion but are now frozen. That image is above the heads of the living being. So who are the heads of the living being? If you imagine Netzach and Hod as a two-headed creature, if you imagine Shekhinah as a two-headed creature with Netzach and Hod as its heads, that's what they're asking you to imagine. In other words, those two flows are informing, just like the brain informs the actions or controls, right? Those two lines of flow are informing the actions of the Shekhinah. The flow here is described in morphic terms. That is what the Maskilim shine like. Right? They shine not like Netzachana, but they shine like the awesome ice. Right? So we have images of fire for the Maskilim. We've had that already, and we'll get that again. But now we get ice, fire and ice. The name of today's episode. There's always a name that emerges. I have to title it on Why Your Torah. Today is fire and ice. So but I never know until we get the right phrase. So fire and ice, right? Here it's ice today. You know, the mystics shine like beautiful ice sculptures, kind of. Or maybe not ice sculptures, but yeah. Okay, Zohar, radiance. Does anyone understand anything about this very, I think this is the most graphic image we've gotten. You know, we've stayed mainly metaphorical until now, but they went right to Ezekiel. You know, the end of this teaching, they deepened the intensity of it.
But I would just say that, like, it's almost like you're like like the Ezekiel imagery is like almost like feels like kind of burying the lead, for like a lack of a better, like, it's surprising that we've taken till this long actually to get to what feels to me like the one of the, you know, most pregnant mystical passages in Tanakh. So maybe that's, but I think we're in an area right now where there's been a few big time teachings over the last couple of weeks. So maybe this is it. Sorry, that's a comment maybe that doesn't really help us move forward, but just like,
no, you know. I think it does. Like, why do they wait until now to go to the images from Ezekiel and map the spherode onto the words of the Ezekiel images? And the answer is, like, they had a lot of things they wanted us to know first, it seems like.
Right.
But there's another weird thing about the Ezekiel passage, and that is so often when we read it, we pay attention to the Merkava, the angels and the wheels and the mechanism, but they're pointing at the backdrop, okay?
Yeah.
At the rakia that's above and behind, and saying that's what you should pay attention to. You know, who cares about, you know, the spaceship?
Right. Look at the space.
Yeah.
And so I will say this, and maybe this is, you know, the whole orientation of the Zohar. I think it's actually less about God and more about us. This is a book about humanity and its religious needs and its religious projections and its mythological stories and its theurgic actions. Even though you could say it's all about the Sefirot, I think this is all about, and to the extent that it's about the Sefirot, it's just like, how do we even exist? But they're interested from a profoundly human perspective, I think. And so maybe that's why, you know, the first mention of Ezekiel isn't the chariot. It's not the Dmut Adam, right? Go right to the image of a person sitting on the chariot. That's the key thing with the four-headed chariot and the ox and the eagle, right? That's the thing to go to. But they go to the ice that's above the chariot because we're the ice. We shine. And the ice reflects something of the divine. Yeah, that's a great point. All of these points are good. Right? Mm-hmm. Zohar, radiance, illumining Torah, illumining, so shining a light on, spotlighting, I'm going to say, because I have an easier time relating to that than illumining, Torah. Zohar, illuminating the heads of that living being. Again, the heads are Netzach and Hod. Those heads are the enlightened who constantly radiate and shine, contemplating that sky. So there's this interesting link between the radiance of the ice and being the ice versus being the heads of Netzach and Hod. There's Tiferet, and then there's Netzach and there's Hod. So there's a little confusion here. And so they're connecting the dots now. Those heads are the enlightened, are the masculine, constantly radiant, contemplating that sky. So Netzach and Hod, how do they reach up into a higher form of consciousness? That is to say, and by the way, Netzach and Hod are thought in the Zohar to be the source of prophecy. That they're the Hod which means, I don't know, splendor, or I guess is a good translation, glory, can be seen as reflective of the prophetic passages that are praising God or noticing God, like these Ezekiel passages, but also like many prophetic passages that are psalm-like in their praise of God. And Netzach, in the passages of the prophets that are calling for social justice or for repentance or reform, because those passages are seeking to have the divine regime be victorious in a kind of long-term way, seeking to repair or fix that which is unjust now. So this balance of appreciation, and they're rooted in opposite instincts. I do want to actually say something about this hero here. Right, Netzach is rooted in a critical instinct to say that the things that exist now, the prophets are profoundly curmudgeonly, right? Everything that exists now is terrible, right? And I think we all relate to those people sometimes. We look at the society and you can look and see wonderful things. You could see whole critiques of ecology and racism and capital. I mean, you could look at the world and appreciate the beautiful day and the human construction and ingenuity, or you could look at a city and see human desecration of the landscape and the erasure of native peoples, right? You could do all kinds of things out your window. I'm looking out my window and seeing what's the positive and negative way to look out my window at downtown Providence. And there are a lot of them, right? And so Netzach is the critical way to look. What is wrong with this? And how does this not map onto the divine image manifest as it should be? And Hod is the opposite. How glorious is God? And these are just, I hope that helps how one is from Chesed and one. What's interesting is that Netzach is on the right side. You know, they imagine that the critical instinct actually comes first from a true critical instinct, comes first from a place of love or loving kindness. And then one's heart breaks for those people who are not currently included, right? That's the way. It's like, it's not that I don't like you. It's that I see the many people in South Providence. I'm looking at South Providence whose, air is less breathable than the air of the East Side just by a few miles because of all kinds of things. And my heart breaks for their worse health outcomes. That's Netzach. Whereas Hod, appreciation, actually comes from Gevura. I need to have some kind of tunnel vision, actually, and restrict my critical instinct and love to appreciate what happens now in a really unmitigated way. I think that's a surprising choice. It's totally defensible and interesting. It's very, but it is a little counterintuitive. So those are the heads, and that's seen as the kind of two-headed root of prophecy in the mystical thinking or worldview of the Zohar. So those heads are enlightened because we're just contemplating that sky. So what do they do? But they contemplate Tiferet. As we said again, Netzach reaches up and Hod reaches up to Tiferet and everything associated with it, represented here by the image of ice. The image of ice. And if anyone has anything more about why ice, awesome ice, that is, Kerach HaNora.
And is it, do we know that it's ice? Because now ice was not a very common thing.
Right.
Right? It was pretty special stuff. Stuff, and maybe in its own way, stranger than precious stones or something.
I'll point out that the JPS translation I'm reading here does say above the heads of the creatures was a form and expanse with an awe-inspiring gleam as of crystal.
Yeah,
right out above their heads.
I mean, so that crystal expresses preciousness more to us. But it may be, that ice was precious enough to be a good image too. I don't know what's a better translation of the Hebrew.
Kerach, what's Kerach? Isn't what's
the question is how they understood it. So it's obviously a puzzling word. I'm not sure how much of this is the modern scholarship. What does, Kerach really mean in the ancient Near East? But what was their tradition of Kerach might be more enlightening.
Right. It's like the Shoshana, the opening of the Zohar. A Shoshana is almost certainly a lily and not a rose. But they understood it to be a rose. They made a whole teaching about a rose. So the fact that it was a northern Israeli water lily in Shir HaShirim, and they imagined it to be a, rose in Spain.
Yeah.
The rose is what interests us. So the question is, can we reverse engineer, and it's hard, we don't get much, what do they imagine, you know, from their interpretation of this Karach HaNorah? Are we able to determine what they have in mind?
My Hebrew app says Karach is ice, so at least for modern Hebrew, that would be
Right.
the Hebrew became ice. Ice in English could be crystal. You can say crystal ice. I don't. There is a certain. Well, whether it's ice or some type of diamond-like thing, it's kind of refracting the light in some shining way. So do they see this as receptor, reflector of in some way of the light that was coming up?
Also, as like a not quite transparent solid support for what's even higher. Ezekiel's looking up and momentarily not distracted by the Merkava and sees this thing and through it sees God or part of God or something, right? Isn't that so?
Let me just read the whole passage, if that's
I need
okay.
to run a work
Oh,
minute here. They always come.
a little early.
thank you, Rabbi.
Yeah, take care.
If
Take care, everybody.
it's okay, I'm just going to read a few, from this is from the Robert Alter commentary. I'm just going to read a few verses before and after to get a feel for the flow of the passage, if that's okay. When the creatures went, the wheels went with them. And when the creatures lifted up above the ground, the wheels lifted up. Wherever the spirit was there to go, there they went. And the wheels lifted up along with them, for the spirit of the creature was in the wheels. When they went, they would go. When they stood still, they would stand still. And when they lifted up above the ground, the wheels would lift up along with them. For the spirit of the creature was in the wheels. And there was a likeness over the heads of the beasts, a platform, that's Rakia in this translation, like the appearance of the fearsome ice stretched over their heads above. And beneath the platform, their wings stood straight and toward each other. Each had two covering them, covering their body. And I heard the sound of their wings, like the sound of many waters, like the sound of Shaddai as they went, like the sound of an uproar, like the sound of an armed camp. When they stood still, their wings grew slack. And there was a sound above the platform that was over their heads. When they stood still, their wings slackened. And above the platform that was over their heads, it was like the look of sapphire stone, the likeness of a throne, and above the likeness of a throne, like a human form upon it above. So that's a little bit more of the passage. It's verses 19 through 27. Here the platform becomes an under becomes Tiferet, and the image above becomes what, Bina or something like that. And right, I think this is important. The ice obscures, but also refracts the light. It itself is also beautiful. So it has all the elements of what you need for emanation, right? As we think about this, right? It reflects light that's from below. It lets light from above come through. It serves as a mitigating barrier. It itself is interesting and wondrous and beautiful, it's connective, it can be fluid, it can melt and turn into water or gas or vapor, it can refreeze again, so it's got some dynamism to it. It's kind of a funny image. It almost puts us in the position of being fish under a frozen sea in the winter or something. Almost feel like they were ice fishing.
Except as you say, we're the fish
We're the
looking up.
fish. Looking up.
Well, that's not, I mean, the idea of like, and I wonder like if the ancients had this idea that what we would call the atmosphere today was some sort of like solid ice substance. And so that's maybe, but surely, but the atmosphere is, it's interesting because like, you know, from the a physics or however, like a scientific standpoint, it's gas, but it's definitely, you know, it's holding everything in, the combination of electromagnetic and gas and kind of all that creates the conditions that allow us to have a fairly stable environment for living beings. So, you know, so they're looking up at that, you know.
I mean, my four-year-old daughter is learning about space in school and asked a, you know, surprisingly complex yet simple question the other day, which is, if you're in a rocket ship, you know, is there one point where you're on Earth and then a minute later you're in space? Or like, how does that work exactly? Right? It's a good, it's just a question. Yeah. Like, where does Earth end in space?
There's transitionary things. I mean, there's, we did this thing on Challenger last year, and it was really interesting because when it exploded, it was like 50,000 feet above the Earth. So it was in that transitionary period. So the, when the space shuttle exploded, it took about 35 minutes for all of the material matter to actually come back on the ground and kind of in this, that making the search really complex. Anyway, it's, yeah, when you get into this rocket ship stuff, it's really wild, you know, so the you know, it's interesting how these metaphors kind of turn back around, I guess, maybe to try to bring it back to us and have, they have a basis in what we are finding to be the actual reality of the physics of atmospheric science and whatnot. I'm like way out of depth here, but just, it's interesting. This thing. And also, I was just going to say, back to Peter's point before about, or I think it was Peter who said, is like, we've always been paying attention to the weird, you know, spaceship thing. And actually what this is pointing us toward is kind of all that environment that's around. And that's kind of that's the mind blowing moment for today, is thinking about that and what's encapsulating us in a way, and what's encapsulating this vision that Ezekiel is expressing.
Yeah. I think that's the crucial observation, and the ability to, it's almost like a group of lefties did this. They like looked at things just a little differently or something, you know, like everyone else is looking at whether they see it a totally different way. Right. But Zohar, I'll just end the teaching here, if that's okay. Radiance, illuminating Torah, illuminating the heads of that living being, those heads of the enlightened who constantly radiate and shine, contemplating that sky, the radiance flashing from there. Radiance of Torah, sparkling constantly, never ceasing. So here by Torah, you know, we mean Tiferet, and Tiferet is associated with the Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah. So that's what they mean. That's when you know they're talking about Tiferet, when they say Torah. But this is a particular definition of Torah, which is particularly interesting, right? What is Torah? It is a, it's not a parch, it's not ink on a parchment. It's the sparkling manifestation of the atmosphere that God, of this thing, you know? I don't know. And it's interesting to think about the Torah, the clock. Sorry. Do I have you? Do I lose you? Yeah. Do I have you? The cloth is pounded. You know, you have to pound the parchment from the skin of the cow. And I almost wonder if Rakia has the sense of, I think in the language, is pounded is really what it means. So there's a sense that this firmament is a flattened, that's what Rekha of Rakia means. There's a sense in which this firmament is somehow chiseled or pounded and or flattened. And I wonder if they saw in the word Rakia, like, oh, yeah, it's like the flattening of the Torah parchment is like the flattening of the natural world and the boundary between earth and what's above, or between God's domain and the earthly domain, right? The Torah is the bridge, link, silkscreen, where we can look at it from one side and God can look at it from the other, and God's light shines through, but it's related to our actions, right? Because the Torah is about what we should do and our own study, and we can have chidushim in it, so it's our actions and behavior, but it's God's background environment and communication and light channeled down. And so, yeah, the Torah, this Rakia is the Torah, you see, they say. And so the Torah shines like the Rakia in Ezekiel. In fact, that's how revelation happens. You see, they begin to say, right, there's like a definition of revelation, because we're talking about Netzach and Hod, those heads. So revelation happens from appreciating the divinity of the Torah, not in a historicity sense, in the spiritual sense.
To me, I think we have, what this is such a vivid visual description, and yet it's not really in the end supposed to be about anything visual or physical or morphic. In the end, it's about Torah. And the maskilim is calling enlightened, right? But the word means like smart. It doesn't mean like illuminated.
Right.
So I think we have to keep going back and forth between the beauty of the visual metaphor and the entirely moral, spiritual, intellectual consciousness situation that it's, I think, representing.
Right, it's almost like the maskilim take all that stuff that it and are able to intellectualize and philosophize and concretize. Right, that is the next form of emanation, and to make it relevant and practical for a concrete world. And so it's not right. It's not even a tension per se, but in other words, the haskalah is the next step in digesting the Zohar Harakia. Right, to be able to take all that inspiration. Now, if the people making the rules are lacking the Zohar, are lacking the Zohar is critiquing that, I think, implicitly. You know, you can imagine them critiquing those religious leaders that dryly make rules without, you know, the spirit of divinity infused within it. And yet they're also apparently critiquing those mystical people that run around like magic shamans without any sense of order or balance to it, you know, or either hermits or immature. Right, so here there's a kind of a thesis for what a mature mystical ecstasy could look like in practical terms. You know, trying to create a community of like ecstatic yet measured intellectual mystics or something.
If I can say, like, I don't know, something about this, like the conversation and what you guys are saying is like when we say Lecha Dodi at the end, like when Shabbat is coming in, like the ideal is like when you get to like Bo'ei V'Shalom that you stand outside or you face west and you're, depending on your tradition, but like you're kind of contemplating the west because that's where the Shekhinah is supposed to come in, like traditionally. So on the one hand, like you're looking at a very vivid, morphic like thing. You're looking at the sunset and in the sky, and it's beautiful, and it kind of works for everything. But at the other hand, what you're welcoming in is kind of the sort of absence of that. So it's this feeling or an intellectual or something. So it's not morphic at all. It's actually, but somehow the Shekhinah is coming in, and what is that exactly? So it feels like that. That moment in Lecha Dodi feels of a piece, I think, with what we're looking at right now.
So that concludes, it's 1 o'clock. This concludes Ma'amar Zohar Harakia, just in time. I was wrong, we didn't get to Tohu Vavohu today. We'll start with Ma'amar Tohu Vavohu next time. But we've now finished the title section of the Zohar. And now I think you know maybe why it's called that. This was a very special group of teachings about what it is we intend to do by studying the Zohar according to the Zohar itself. All these things, the parade of letters and the fire of the letters and the Breshit Barashit creating six with Chochmah and all of that. And this ultimately coming into how to bring and manifest the divine in the Torah, through the Torah into the reality of the world. And actually, I think it's fitting, I'll note this, we're ending with Torah, and we start with the Chochmah, and they interpret that as a Torah Kedumah, was the word of the thing, the primordial Torah. So we've moved from the primordial Torah of the Chochmah bar Elohim at the Shema, you know, that Elohim was created from amidst the primordial Torah of wisdom that emerged, and ultimately the Maskilim contemplate the radiance of that Torah in order to manifest, you know, the reality. And the Shekhinah. So the Torah has been the central, has been the protagonist, actually, of this teaching as the Torah.
Beautiful. Thank you, Rabbi.
Absolutely. Right, yeah,
thank you all.
Yeah.
Next week, see you then.